So my podcasting program is called Adelaide Chronicles, and I'd like to welcome you to Adelaide Chronicles. That is all about stories from Adelaide and about the people that have influenced Adelaide. And it's people don't necessarily have to come from Adelaide, but they have input into it. And Adelaide, of course, is on Kaurna land. My
name's Andrew Rogers. I'm an industrial designer. A lot of people don't know what industrial designers do. Industrial designers are the people that make the things that you take for granted possible. So your toaster, your light switch, your table, your glasses. Anything that you touch or feel that's been manufactured is usually, if it's a good quality product, been crafted by an industrial designer. We make sure that the best use of materials are used, that we make sure that the best possible value of materials are used and the best possible user experience comes out at the end of that process. So when you buy a product, you get a good product.
So when you say we, are you meaning all industrial designers or your team?
All good industrial designers.
In your company name, you have an implication of sustainability as being one of your key principles?
Yes. It's very convenient that Andrew Rogers Industrial Design has an acronym of ARID. We live in ARID, which is South Australia, a very arid, dry state and driest country in the world. I believe from the very beginning, when my family first arrived in South Australia in 1971, that we came to a place that was ready to do something interesting and exciting. I've been here since, as I said, a very young boy. We migrated from England, and I've been through the entire education system in South Australia. I was very lucky enough to study industrial design with Bob Miller-Smith, who worked with the university to develop it was then South Australian College of Advanced Education. He worked with the Premier at that stage, and we had the first Bachelor of Design in the world was actually put forward here in South Australia because of Bob Miller-Smith and the Premier at that time. This was all leading on Don Dunstan, who had spent a lot of time creating and culturing the arts and making it possible for people to understand the value of the creative industries. And I think in many cases the value of the creative industries is being lost on politics at the moment. The amount of value that creative people can add to the environment of society, and I don't mean simply the environment of animals, but I mean the environment of society, of people, that we can add significant value in a cultural way. We don't really always want to have products that are me too, products that have come from another country and then we absorb them into our society. We need to have our own sense of community, our own sense of style, our own sense of creativity, and that needs to come from people that work and live in our environment.
So it's just that very reason that you've come to our attention.
Thank you.
You're repurposing at the moment, aren't you? And can you tell us a little bit about that?
I had the fortunate situation of having a very interesting adventure. At the beginning of this year, I was in China. I go to China for business, for work. This particular time I was in China, and we found out firsthand about COVID-19. It didn't have a name at that point, but I was there with my family. We ended up, instead of staying in a hotel, we ended up staying in my sister-in-law's two-room apartment for 2 weeks, trying to get an airplane back to Australia. We couldn't get a sooner flight than we already had booked, and we ended up arriving back in Adelaide on the 31st of January, feeling very relieved and happy, but also very concerned, and decided that we'd stay home for 2 weeks during that period to make sure that we were clear of any chance of having the virus with us. I was lucky then that we spent 2 weeks out and about, drinking, having dinner, going to Indian restaurant, had a good little moment. But then it started becoming present here in Adelaide. And I and another designer who I've been doing some work for, who runs a company called Chiron, who make very high-end audio equipment for audiophiles. We've been working on a project together for nearly 18 months to develop these very high-end stereo systems. The market at this point in time isn't ripe for people spending a lot of money on hi-fi equipment, and we also felt that we needed, as responsible people in the society, to do something, to be able to make a difference. And making a difference is something that I'm really keen to do. So we thought about it for a while, what could we do quickly that would be effective, that could make a difference to people and help people out. And one of the things that we were all aware of is that we have children, we have young people in society, and we know that people that are working in supermarkets who are getting harassed and abused by people, they're just doing their job. They need to be looked after and protected in the best way that we can do it. We also knew that the PPE equipment was very expensive and getting very difficult to get hold of. Making a filtered mask, you need special equipment, special materials, and it's very difficult to get together very quickly. So we thought that coming up with a shield to prevent from sneeze and spit and the things that large particles is going to help. And it also gives you the ability to be able to still see somebody smile if you're working with them in the supermarket. You don't really know what's going on behind the mask. A prime example of that is when I first landed in Adelaide. We landed in Adelaide, we were all very worried about what was going on, and then we had a customs border force officer come on. He had a full mask on. All we could see were his eyes. We had no way of telling whether he was happy or grumpy or aggressive. He just walked through the cabin handing out pieces of paper without actually acknowledging that we were even there. So that gave me a really strong impression that, as Australians, we often grunt. We don't communicate. Not a lot of Australians are as verbose as we could be. And a grunt, if it's depending on what's on your face, your facial expression can mean many, many different things. So we felt as designers that we needed to protect the public but also allow full communication through facial expression. And that's why we came up with the idea of a face shield. The idea of calling it Ned's Head came about simply because at that point I was flicking through some art books and I saw one of Nolan's paintings, not the Ned Kelly series, but Nolan instantly came to mind, and we said, okay, we'll call it Ned's Head. It's the perfect...
Looks a bit like...
Perfect, yeah. And it works. Yeah. And so we called it Ned's Head, and that's where the idea came from. The intention was to come up with a simple, quick-to-produce product that could protect as many people as possible without hiding people behind the masks that have become so common around other places in the world.
And we were talking earlier, and you mentioned that you have very close contact with people who absolutely need PPE.
Yeah. I have my niece, who is mother of two, who I've known since she was 2 years old. She's a nurse in the intensive care unit in Adelaide, and she needs to be protected and looked after. The mother of four of my children is a nurse, and she needs to be protected. My daughter works in the Burnside City Council, and she is sometimes confronted by not always happy people in the council chambers. And so having a level of protection that helps people understand social distancing, but at the same time gives the option for people to be able to see somebody's face and their expression and see how they're working is what Ned's Head is about. It's about giving people the option of being behind a shield or a screen without hiding their expressions.
So one of the things you've previously done is make quite exquisite looking cast iron saucepans or woks.
Yes, well, that's a very interesting project, and again, that will go very well with your understanding of environment and recycling. They're actually made from aluminium. I was approached by a company to design something with the leftover pieces between round frying pans. So you have a square, rectangular piece of metal. You punch round bits out and you end up with these funny little ninja stars. And they asked me, can you design something with these? And I said, sure, let's have a think. And I went back to my studio and thought about it for a while, then went back to them with just one piece of paper with some numbers on it. And I explained to them that, you know, they should be doing something a bit different. And they didn't like the idea that I was telling them how to make frying pans, because they wanted me to make some desk ornaments or something a little bit trendy with these little bits of metal. But I explained to them that they didn't know anything about anodizing, they didn't know anything about bending metal, they didn't know anything about stationery, they didn't know anything about distribution of those products, but they knew an awful lot about frying pans and distribution of frying pans and packagings and coatings and painting and finishing. So if they spent a small amount, $60,000 on a small furnace, which they could use natural gas to heat the aluminium, they could then recycle those bits of metal, which they were getting $1.60 for, which they're paying $8 a kilo for, they're paying getting $1.60 as scrap, sell them as a pan for $30 a kilo. So we're taking what was their scrap material and turning it into a very high value added product, which turned into wedding gifts. So David Jones and Myers bought those, and they sold those for nearly 12 years.
So you went from exclusive frying pans to PPE?
Yes.
Did you have to repurpose your machinery?
No. I have my workshop is set up for design and development, and design and development means that I need to have a very flexible toolkit. My toolkit varies from precision measuring equipment that measures to three decimal places of a millimetre, to chisels and hand saws and basic equipment like that. Includes laser cutters, 3D printing equipment, which I use very rarely, 3D CNC milling machines, and a CAD-CAM system so that I can do all of my design work on that.
So it's not just that it's a full face helmet that confronted you when you first came in, it's also that there's a huge PPE shortage.
Absolutely. One of the things that concerned me is that when I came back into Australia, I heard stories of people buying not only toilet paper but also PPE, and vast quantities of PPE are being purchased and sent overseas. And the interesting thing about it is that some of the countries that are manufacturing the PPE have a standard that they manufacture for their own country, and they manufacture it at a higher standard for export. And what's happening is that that product that was being exported and had been exported was being bought up and then sent back to the original country of manufacture, so that the people in the know that understand the value of high-quality PPE had the high-quality PPE, and then they were selling back to Australia the low-quality product. That alarmed me significantly, particularly when I understood that a lot of the PPE that's being sent to Australia, the N95, is actually not waterproof. And so fluid, if it gets wet, it becomes almost ineffective very quickly. And that's why having a plastic shield in front of the mask also extends the life of the mask, as well as protecting you from fluid striking in your eyes and nose and mouth.
And a plastic shield that can be made out of Coke bottles?
Yep. And so we looked at different materials, and one of the materials that is quite common is PET, and PET is what all of your Coke bottles and soft drink bottles and even some beer bottles and wine bottles are made out of now. PET is a very stable, very reusable, recyclable, repurposable material. One of the things that drove me to understanding the idea of using the PET was that I saw a photograph or a short video of somebody in Germany and Italy who had taken a Coke bottle and cut it up and used a bit of sticky tape and just cut it to put on themselves. So they'd taken 20 minutes to make this shield themselves out of a Coke bottle. Now, yes, if you've got the time and you understand how, many people can make their own PPE. But why should nurses that are working in the government and people that are working in hospitality and people that are preparing food for other people and people that are working for multinational banks have to make their own PPE? And why should they have PPE that looks like an old Coke bottle stuck on their face? We wanted to design a product that looked good, that worked well, but was sustainable. So we chose the PET. Too many acronyms. The PET, because we knew that it was almost infinitely recyclable. The PET that we're using contains more than 30% recycled material. So what that means...
To be turned back into the same thing?
Yes. So what happens is that the Coke bottles, or Coke is ubiquitous name for soft drinks, so anything that comes in a soft drink, transparent material, they simply take the labels off, take the lids off, they grind it up, they melt it, and then they put it through an extruder, and it comes out the machine as film, and that film is then cut and then put into a package and then assembled to create the product. Once it's done its purpose, it can be then put back into the machine again and recycled.
So where are you at with your negotiations?
We have sold a number of products to New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania. Biggest sales have been into Tasmania at this point in time. We're currently negotiating with Health SA and a number of other hospitals around South Australia, some private hospitals, and also some looking at a public tender in Victoria and Queensland at the moment. We've had product samples in with Health SA for some time now, which have gone through some very rigorous testing. In fact, they've been tested to comply above this Australian standards and have passed. We're now waiting for them to get through the paperwork and the red tape to be able to give us an opportunity to supply a
And then what do you do?
What do we do when we get the order? We start making product. We can make 2,000 products.
And you employ people?
Well, yes, we employ people. We will be employing probably more than 10 people, which are currently unemployed. We have a couple that we've already taken on. So we have Ross, who's just started with us 2 days ago. He's working, a week ago now. He's working, preparing samples and checking and doing quality control. We are engaging... We just engaged a sales manager this morning. Things are moving pretty quickly, so I'm trying to remember when things happen. And we expect that we will have to take about between 250 and 500 square metres. We don't know yet because of the spacing that we'll have to put between the workstations. It will be significantly more space than we would normally have to for the safety.
Because of the virus,
Of the virus, yeah. All the floors will be properly painted and sealed. Everyone will be wearing hats and masks and eyewear and covering shoes, hands and sanitation. And temperatures will be taken at least twice a day just so that we can maintain a safe working environment.
So do you need particular skills to work in your factory?
No. In fact, it's one of the positive things I got out of studying Henry Ford's methodologies. He always liked to employ people that knew nothing so that he could train them to be his experts.
I was just reading about Henry Ford today.